afternoon, everyone. I'm Pam Stack, your host, and welcome to Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Welcome to this very special Thursday afternoon edition of Authors on the Air. My guest today is William Myers Jr., whose debut novel was a runaway bestseller. It was called A Criminal Defense. Mind-boggling books, just so good. He is just releasing his second book called An Engineered Injustice. It released 2 days ago on Tuesday, and I'm so honored that he took the time out to talk to me. Bill Myers, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Pam, thank you for having me on. I'm really excited to be doing this.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. You know, it seems like the obvious place to start would be with your book, but I kind of want to go back and talk to you about your upbringing and your background, because you state in your bio that you had a very blue-collar, working-class upbringing. And I wonder, in that upbringing, who instilled books and writing in you?
Well, I did grow up in a blue-collar house. My father was a boiler mechanic, and I would work with him during the summers to help clean oil burners and do all the physical types of things. My mother is the one who really installed the love of books for me. And one thing that she did when I was really young, when I was in even fifth and sixth grades, was I would write stories, and the teachers would take me around to the classrooms and have me read them. And my mother would type them up for me. And we'd talk about the stories as I was writing them. And she would say, does this really make sense to you? Would somebody really say something like this? So it would be kind of a give and take.
That's amazing to me at such a young age that your mom was shaping what would become a very successful second career for you. For background, you are an Ivy League educated gentleman who went to Pennsylvania for law school. And you mentioned, interestingly enough, that you worked at this mega defense firm. I'm assuming that was defending corporate entities. Yet you kind of grew weary of that. Will you take us on the story from there?
Yeah, Pam, and thanks for asking. I did start out, because I went to Penn Law, which is an Ivy League school, like most of my contemporaries, I went right to a big corporate defense firm. And we represented mostly big corporations. And for me, a turning point came during a deposition of a man who had contracted asbestos-related disease. Our firm at the time was representing an asbestos company, and the man was dying, and so his lawyer realized his deposition had to be taken because he would never make it to court, and they needed to have him on a videotape for the jury to see. And his lawyer was asking him questions, and this was in his house, literally on his deathbed, and his lawyer was asking him questions about his life. And this was a completely self-made man. He started out as a young guy working at a naval yard where there's a lot of asbestos. He and some friends founded a construction firm. It did very well. He ended up building his own house. He built his own airplane. And as he talked about his life, I became just incredibly impressed with him. And I walked out of that deposition, Pam, thinking, I'm on the wrong side. I should be representing guys like this. I should be representing people like the people I grew up with, like the people in my family. I shouldn't be representing these giant corporations.
Wow. That's a powerful moment in your life, isn't it?
It was. It was a turning point for me.
How long after that case did you decide to change it up and open your own firm?
It was within, I want to say it was within a year and a half or 2 years. And I looked around and I found the type of law firm where I went to the managing partner, and he said to me, look, we're a little law firm. Why do you want to leave a great big firm and come to work for us? And, you know, I told him about this deposition, and I also said, I want to try cases. And at this big mega firm, as a junior associate, I'm not going to be the guy trying cases. And he said to me, if you come with my firm, you can try all the cases you want. And so I went there, and I just started trying cases left and right. As many cases as I could get to trial, I took to trial, and I got my butt kicked quite a few times early on, but
sure.
learned the trial business the only real way you can learn it, which is to go out and be in the trenches and do it.
It's kind of like a metaphor for everything else. You have to treat failure as your professor. Do you agree?
Yeah. I heard somebody once, and I'm trying to think who it was. He was just in a fight. He lost a fight. And he said, I don't win or lose. I win or learn.
There you go. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
So you're trying these cases and you're really feeling it now. I'm sure you found your zen spot there. And but you've always had a love of books, and writing as a child must still be in the back of your mind someplace. So how did a criminal defense come about, and had you been thinking about it for a long time?
Well, I actually started writing novels about 25 years ago. I just sat down and decided I wanted to write, and I started writing. And I wrote a full-length novel, and it was terrible. I wrote another full-length novel, and it was terrible. But I kept on writing, and I started reading books on how to write and books on how to craft story. And about, I want to say 6 years ago, Pam, I sat down and I said, I'm going to write a commercially viable book, something that can sell, something that's very readable. And it took me about 2 years to write the book. A lot of trial and error, a lot of chapters written and torn up and rewritten again and again and again. But after about 2 years, I finally had my working draft. And then, of course, getting it actually published was a whole story unto itself.
Well, you're published with Thomas and Mercer, correct?
I am.
They're a terrific company.
They're great.
Yeah.
They are, and I will tell you that the people who work for them have so much enthusiasm for what they do, and they make it so easy, or made it so easy for me as an author to get the book through editing and the whole publication thing. I can't say enough good things about them.
I'm so glad. So let's talk about your first book that, as I mentioned, is a runaway bestseller. And you don't have to look at numbers in PW or anything to know. You have, almost across the board, over 5,200 five-star reviews in Amazon, which is unheard of. I mean, these numbers come from people who've been writing forever. And for a debut book, and believe me, I purchased this book back in May of last year. It is just simply a stunning, stunning debut. Will you share with listeners a little bit about the story? And I just want to preface that by saying, I always hear writers say you have to write what you know. You are obviously a Philadelphia lawyer, and this involves a Philadelphia courtroom. Tell us about the book, please.
Sure. Thanks, Pam. I am a Philadelphia lawyer, and so the story is set in Philadelphia. And if you live in Philadelphia, you'll recognize a lot of the places, the restaurants, the courtroom, the courthouse itself, the streets. And the premise of the book is there's a criminal defense attorney. His name is Mick McFarland, and he has a friend from law school named David Hansen, very wealthy man, very successful man, who is accused of murdering a journalist, and he's actually caught at the scene, running away from the scene. And he contacts Mick, and he asks Mick to represent him. And the story, as it unfolds, all the characters have a lot of different levels to them. And what you realize is that every character in the book is somehow or other involved in the death of this journalist. And every character in the book has secrets and an agenda. And as the book progresses, the layers get peeled off one by one, and you realize what the involvement is, what the relationships really are, not just the superficial relationships. And then at the very, very end of the book, you realize, you find out who actually was physically responsible for killing this girl.
Wow. It's a powerful story, I have to tell you. So I want to ask, do you do criminal law in your practice now, or this was a totally contrived for the story?
Yeah, I don't do criminal law. I do civil law. So for me, I had to do a lot of research, not just learning the criminal law rules and stuff like that, but actually going to the criminal courthouse in Philadelphia, which is about 3 blocks from my office, and watching arraignments and preliminary hearings and a murder trial to see where do the characters stand, how do they conduct themselves, how are these sometimes very idiosyncratic procedures, how are they actually conducted, so that I can convey the atmosphere and the tension and what's really going on between the lawyers and the court in each of those situations.
It's completely uncivilized compared to civil litigation, isn't it?
It's night and day.
It really is. I am a certified victim advocate, and so I am in criminal courts a lot of times with victims, and it's crazy. It really is. Whereas when I go to watch my brother try a case, and in corporate litigation, they don't go to trial that often, but it's always so civilized. I almost envision, you know, powdered white wigs and so forth, waistcoats. But it's a completely different world. Did it make you happy that you don't do criminal law when you sat through some of these things?
It's like a two-sided coin. In one sense, it makes me happy that in my forums, they're much more. They are more civilized, they're more regulated, it's not as down and dirty in the trenches, although you can have, you know, moments of great passion. On the other hand, I think, you know what, I wish I would have started out as an assistant district attorney and gotten down and dirty from the beginning, way down in the trenches, in this kind of bare knuckles type of situation, because it is, you know, so much more is at stake, Pam. Freedom as opposed to just money. And it has, you can see this when you sit in the courtroom, it doesn't just affect the lives of the defendant who's on trial, but it affects the lives of the victim, their family, his family.
Right. Absolutely. It's an all-encompassing type thing. That's not to say in civil court it doesn't affect them also, but the stakes are a little bit different. One is more life stakes and the other is more monetary stakes. Would you agree?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Now with a person in the civil side, if you represent a person who's badly injured enough where they're not going to work anymore, you're talking about their entire quality of life. If they prevail in the court, they're going to have a comfortable, dignified life. If they don't prevail in court and they can't work for a living anymore, they and the family they were providing for are going to suffer for real.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I want to wind back again to your writing when you were a child and also over the course of the years that you said you've written all these books. Do you have any of those books that you wrote as a child or any of those essays or short stories that your mom typed up for you?
I wish I did. I really wish I did. You know, when you're a little kid, you don't even think about, well, I'll keep this for posterity, because you don't think about the future. But I think it would be really fun to if somewhere those stories still existed.
It would be. And do you have your unpublished novels, like, in a bottom drawer someplace?
They're all saved on the computer. I have hard copies. Some are in my office. Some are at home. But I have computer copies stored on the computer. And, it's funny, Pam, because my wife went back and started reading one that I did years ago.
Uh-huh.
And she said, boy, this is really bad. You really have matured as a writer.
Do you think, I mean, I think this makes sense, but when you write briefs for court, and and I guess it's a little bit different in civil than it is in criminal, but you really can't use a lot of extraneous words. It's not a deep narrative or anything like that. It's kind of just the facts, even though it is civil. Does that sharpen the focus on your fiction writing so that you're really just talking about moving the story forward, Bill?
Yeah, I think it has. It makes me, I don't use a lot of extra words, not a lot of flowery language. My sentences tend to be short and to the point, and they are to get the story moving from point A to point B.
That's the way it should be. It really should. Your books are not excessively long. They're an average of 300 pages, a little over 300 pages. And, you know, I think that's a good thing. A lot of people, and maybe you found this to be different, but do not have the time nor the inclination to read really long stories anymore. And I don't know how much time you have to read for enjoyment for yourself. I'm very lucky I get to read a lot. And I like long books, but I don't mind a really good quick read, you know, of something really powerful. So let's talk about the next book that just released on Tuesday. It's called An Engineered Injustice. It's an interesting title. So first of all, where did that title come from?
Well, it's a play on words. It's a story set that revolves around a train crash. And I premised the book or based it very loosely on there was a big train crash in Philadelphia a few years ago. And there have been train crashes since then. It seems like it's happening more and more. And so I created a story where a train crashes and very powerful forces want to go after the engineer for causing the crash. The engineer is the cousin of the protagonist, Vaughn Coburn, who is a young lawyer. And Vaughn and his cousin, Eddie, the engineer, share a secret from childhood where Vaughn owes Eddie for something he did that hurt his cousin when they were younger. And as the story progresses, you learn that this train accident was not an accident. And that's why the title is a play on words, An Engineered Injustice.
Right.
It involves an engineer, but the injustice itself was engineered. It was planned.
You know, you mentioned something. You said that train crashes are happening more and more often. So you really picked a timely topic. First of all, why do you think train crashes are happening more often, just as an aside?
Well, I mean, and this is an area of the law that I practice. I represent a lot of railroad employees. My personal opinion, I think there's a lax safety culture at a number of different railroads. I think the training is not as good as it needs to be. And from time to time, people make honest mistakes. You can be an engineer. You can be running a train. You can be running it over an area where you've run the train before, and something happens, and you get distracted. And you're not a bad person. You're not a criminal. You've made a mistake, but the consequences are so enormous.
You know, I always wondered about that. I wonder how – is this a profession that is – people are flocking to anymore these days? Is this are crashes a consequence of our lack of infrastructure building, or is a little bit of everything?
It's probably a little bit of everything. I don't think it's so much the infrastructure, because if you look into the details of how these accidents are happening, it's not because a bridge collapses. It's because a train goes around a curve too fast, or a train goes through a red signal for one reason or another.
Yes, yes. Interesting. So how much research did you put into this book, Bill?
I put a lot of research into it, and I looked up a whole bunch of different train accidents, tried to figure out what made them happen, what were the different theories. I was already pretty familiar with the equipment involved, that is, the type of engines and the trains and the type of tracks they go across. So I knew all that. And then what I also did was I went back and looked at the video coverage, the news coverage, and the coverage on the internet, even YouTube videos of people, taken by people involved in the crash. So in the book, when I'm describing the crash and the crash scene and what the people went through, I based that on what I actually saw in real crashes and what the people were saying who survived, how they described it, what physically was happening with the bodies and the people and the luggage inside the train as the train was derailing.
It's a scary thought. It's a scary thought. So your books ring so true, though, and I'm not sure how I would describe your style, but don't talk down to your reader, which I appreciate, because I think most people who read are fairly smart people. I mean, they read books, for crying out loud.
Right,
so
right.
I really appreciate that you tell the story without shoving the story down their throats. It's a very nice characteristic for an author to have. And so congratulations on your success. Will you be putting out another book, and have you started working on it?
Yes and yes. Amazon, Thomas and Mercer, because of the success of the first book and what is looking like it's going to be the success of the second book, signed me to another two-book deal, and I'm about 80% through the third book right now.
Wow. You're becoming a writing machine. Are you willing to give up lawyering for authoring?
No, and I'll tell you why. When I'm writing, I'm sitting in a room. It could be my living room. It could be my office. But I'm sitting there, and I'm by myself, and I'm inside my own head. When I'm practicing law, it's exactly the opposite. I could still be in a room, but it's all interactions with other people. You know, it's making decisions, it's running a firm, it's meeting with clients, meeting with the staff, two very different ways of living. And just writing a book and just, you know, being totally introspective is fun for periods of time, but I couldn't do that all day, every day. I need the part, the social part, the interacting with people part.
That makes sense to me. I understand it completely. We are almost at the end of our time, but I do want to, first of all, ask you to tell everyone where they can find you on the internet, please.
Yes, you can find me. Well, if you go to Amazon, the easiest way is just to go to Amazon and either look up the book A Criminal Defense, or look up the book An Engineered Injustice, or look up my name, William L. Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, Jr., fastest way to do it.
Very good. And I recommend that you go there. Bill has a really great Amazon author page, and with a lot of information about him, something that a lot of authors don't do, but I'm glad that you do. So usually at the end of my show, I do final five, which is five quick questions and five quick answers. Are you game to play?
Okay.
Good. Okay,
you didn't tell me you were going to do that, but that's okay. I'll do my best.
I can't reveal all my secrets, right? You don't reveal all your strategies, so I don't reveal all the things I'm going to do. But it's all about you, so it won't be difficult. Are there other creative people in your family?
My brother Jeff is very creative. He self-taught himself the guitar, and he can play acoustic guitar. He can play a number of different types of guitars, and he taught himself to sing. He's very creative.
How wonderful. How wonderful. That's terrific. Is your mom alive to see your success in writing?
No, and that's something that upsets me. She passed in June 4 years ago. And she knew I was writing. She knew I was trying to get books published, but she never got to see the final book and see the success. And I wish to God she had been able to do that.
Oh, yeah, I bet you do. But, you know, I'm sure from someplace on high she's very thrilled.
you must read quite a bit, because I don't think you can write without reading. Do you have an opportunity to read fiction? And if so, who are you currently reading?
I do read fiction a lot. Right now I'm reading Preston and Child's latest Pendergast novel, A City of Endless Night.
Oh, you're going to love it. City of Endless Night. They were on yesterday when the studio finally came back online. Yeah, it's a terrific book. You're going to love it.
Yeah, I love their books. I love the character, Aloysius Pendergast.
Yep.
I've been of late really getting into Michael Connelly's, the whole Bosch series of books.
Yep.
And, you know, there are so many of them. You can read them, and by the time you're done, he has another one coming out.
It's
Dennis
true.
Lehane. I love the Kenzie and Gennaro series. And Elmore Leonard. I love Elmore Leonard. I love his style of writing. I would love to be able to write like that.
You know, a lot of authors say that to me. A lot of writers say that to me. And the interesting thing is that he, and I'm paraphrasing, but he said, you know, don't write stuff people don't want to read. And it's just like, it makes
right.
so much sense, doesn't it, Bill? So,
it does.
Is there one book that's your go-to favorite that you've gone back and read more than once?
There have been a number. I used to like Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand. When I was younger, I like to read some of the older books. Like, I love War and Peace. I've read War and Peace 3 times.
Oh, my God. Really?
Yeah. Yeah. And
dictionary.
It is. It's like reading a dictionary and a phone book all tied in together.
Yeah.
But I don't know. There's just something about it. I don't know. It touches me. It really does.
Well, God bless you. I'm telling you. So here's my final question. Let me think. What should I ask you? Okay. Your mom and I are communicating through the internet, and we decide we're going to write a book about your life. What do you think we're going to title it?
I would say Not There Yet.
Oh, I don't know. You're getting there.
I'm getting there, but let me tell you something. I have a lot to learn, Pam. I read other authors who've been doing this for a lot longer than I have, and I don't know. Some of these people seem so much better than me. I'm trying, I'm struggling, I'm doing it, and the sales are great, and, you know, the success is great, but I still feel like I have a whole lot to learn.
Well, and maybe that's a good thing, because that will keep you fresh and interesting for each successive book, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, you have to have a motivation. You have to. If you think you're done, you know, this is as good as it's going to get, what's your motivation to keep doing it?
Exactly. And the fact is, if that is the attitude, I think the quality of the work, it kind of slacks off too. William L. Myers, Jr., best-selling author of A Criminal Defense, and now the newly released and Engineered Injustice, both books are sitting in my hand right now. Congratulations on your success. I'm thrilled for you. And continued success with your law firm. Will you come back when the new book is released?
Absolutely. I'd be honored and happy.
Thank you so much for spending your afternoon with me. I know you're busy at your law firm, but it's very precious to me that you spent time with me, and all the success in the world. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you, Pam. Thank you again.
Okay, have a good afternoon.
You too.
Bye-bye. And that's our special show for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to Bill Myers, Jr. I encourage you to go get his books. Oh, my God, he's a spectacular writer. Thanks for being with me, and thank you, Mom and Dad. Goodbye.